Hi, everyone. Welcome to the annual Reason Roundtable Webathon video bonus episode. I'm Matt. That's Nick. That's Kathy.
Oh, God, don't touch Nick.
This is going to be fine. We've spent a lot of time in each other's company during the pandemic. We have absolutely forgotten how to behave. Hi, how is everybody doing?
Hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Happy to be here.
Happy Webathon.
Yeah, that's enough moderation. What we're going to do here is you sent a bunch of questions and we're going to answer them. In years past, we've given soliloquies about how much Reason has meant to all of us individually, careerly, and in the world. It might come up again. We're going to try to get through as many questions as possible. In the meantime, some to the gang, some to those of us individually. Let's start with Brandon. Let's go. To Brandon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fuck you, Matt.
strong start.
Brandon writes, can you make a case, and we'll direct this at Catherine to begin with, can you make a case for why libertarians should intellectually engage with mainstream journalism? Certain types of libertarians seem to have a tendency to immediately dismiss any source because of real or imagined biases that are connected to a publisher that is considered mainstream, like The Atlantic, New York Times, or Washington Post. Again, all the places where Peter Suderman's wife is working. Reason, on the other hand, seems to more deeply interact with content from such sources in ways beyond simply mocking them when they get things wrong. What value do you find there is in doing so for a libertarian audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is kind of obvious, which is that if we want to have more libertarians, then we should talk to and about people and publications that aren't only libertarian, that don't already agree with us. I think dismissing a publication because it has bias is the wrong approach. And I say that not least because I edit a publication that has bias. Like we just happen to put our bias on the tin. We sort of say it up front. Hey, here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it on the tin. That's what they say. It's okay. What it says on the tin, on the label. I'll translate it to American for you. You know, I wish that The Atlantic and The Washington Post and others were maybe a little more upfront about their biases, but I think that is not a reason to engage with the legitimate factual claims that people make, with the analytical problems that they posit. And yeah, we want to be part of, I think Nick Gillespie can agree, we want to be part of a conversation. We want to get a conversation going.
Actually want to dominate the conversation.
Guide the conversation.
Yes. You know,
the brontosaurus approach doesn't work for...
The friendly brontosaurus is not a journalistic tool.
I do think there are, generally speaking, two types of, in almost any subculture, but certainly a libertarian one, of people who want to kind of take over the world in a positive way. Of course, that means, you know, we take over the world and leave them alone. But you want to influence the mainstream culture and you want to kind of integrate into it so that they become more interested in and reflective of libertarian beliefs. There's another subset which almost sees, and you know, this comes up a lot in like indie music scenes, where it's like when U2 or REM went from smaller labels to big bad Warner Brothers or national labels, they sold out.
Right.
It's like, no, you know, this is about society and it's about changing things. And like you can be a small band of, you know, perfectly pure, perfectly clean, usually kind of uninteresting and insane people, because you only talk to people who agree with you or egg you on to more and more extreme points of view, or you can be more open-ended and actually live your life and try and persuade people who don't agree with you, this is a better direction to go in. So that's the argument for engaging always with the mainstream to change it, and maybe also to break it up into smaller and smaller things so there's less of a mainstream, which is one of the great triumphs, I would argue, of libertarian thought over the past 40 years.
So I will say, professionally, I think, like, I deeply believe in this engagement strategy and the kind of, like, if anyone wants to join us in any part of the coalition, that's great. Personally, I have 100% stopped trying to convince the people in my life of anything.
Sure.
Like, I'm just tired.
This is, we're going including straight to the co-workers. Therapy session.
We're going straight to the therapy session.
Including co-workers.
That's what this special Webathon episode is about, right?
I would point out, so in 2008 was when we first started the Webathon, and I think we've already exceeded our 2008 numbers, so thank you very much for donating to this 501c3. But we also, that was the 40th anniversary issue. I was newly editor, having been given the baton by Nick Gillespie. And we did a oral history of Reason Magazine pursuant to this, because it's an early point when Bob Poole, Manny Klausner, and Tibor McCann took over management of the magazine from from Landy Friedlander, should remember that name. They had a little internal newsletter that covered the Libertarian Party, which is another question that comes up always in these things. And all the infighting. You'd be surprised to know that the Libertarian Party was infighting even back in the early 70s. It created a lot of sort of tension, and they had a decision to make. Should we be the kind of, you know, in-house magazine for libertarianism purely, or should we be what they called an outreach magazine of trying to get involved in the larger media conversation? And they chose decisively on the outreach. And I think that was for the institution, the right decision. Amen. All right, let's direct this to Peter. This comes from Kevin from Cedar Rapids. With the rollouts of the COVID vaccines over the past year, when each of you became fully vaccinated, what was the first big normal thing? He said thing, not dog. First big normal thing you did entertainment-wise?
It took a little while to get new dogs this year. But no, the first thing I did was I went back to the movies. And I went back to a theater. Theaters in Washington, D.C. had been closed for much of last year and for the beginning of this year. And I went back to the Georgetown AMC. And I saw the Bob Odenkirk John Wick film. Nobody, right? People were referring to it as Bob Wick. And it was exactly what I wanted to see, because it wasn't a great movie, but it was witty and violent, trashy fun, kind of what I really enjoy about movies in a lot of ways, or just sort of the regularity of movies, something that is just sort of a cheap but engaging entertainment that took, you know, it's like a short movie. It's like 89 minutes or something like that. And I went back and this was, I think, 9 days after my first shot. So I don't even know if I actually had any antibodies, but I was like, I am done. I'm ready to go. And it was super wonderful just to be sitting there with a friend and with a bunch of strangers who were like watching a movie that we all enjoyed.
Nick, what did you do?
I don't really remember, because by the time the vaccines came, I had already started reliving my life for the most part. Yeah. I do remember going to Greenwich, Connecticut. Living in New York City, the theaters were closed. Connecticut opened its theaters briefly. And so I took a train up to Greenwich, Connecticut to see Tenet, the horrible movie. That was one of the first big movies to come out in a theater, and it was myself and about five other people.
Did you fall asleep?
Yes, yeah. I did. And the real problem was that when I woke up, Tenet was still going on.
Actually, it had restarted. Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
You followed the movie just as well as the people who had
pretty,
stayed.
I think I got
thing.
A better, yeah. better. And then
it's
I also
a great
did this.
Movie, guys. It totally makes sense.
It is a horrible movie, and it's Christopher Nolan's Walk of Shame. Luckily, nobody saw it. So, and then I did the same thing. I went to New Jersey because the theaters in New Jersey were open, and I went across to Jersey City, and I saw The New Mutants, which had been held on the shelf for like 30 years. It was so bad. And then they released it when nobody could go. And that too was a disappointment. So then I stopped going to movies, and I decided to live life, damn it.
By live life, means take drugs. Catherine, what did you do on your...
I strongly dislike being cold. And so most of my pandemic, like the besides, of course, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the big cost of the pandemic for me was that I had to socialize outdoors. And I hate being cold. So there was like a lot of dumb, like, we'll all sit around a fire pit with our gloves on and like pretend like this is
drink
okay.
Cocktails.
Just like so many cocktails. Yeah. It didn't help. And so the thing that I did after I was vaccinated was
I'm sorry,
just
my
like,
cocktails always help.
Yeah, I mean, it was, that's true. But having people to my house indoors to sit in my house with me and eat food, like that's all I want. I'm a simple woman. And that's what I did when the pandemic was.
I was kind of like Nick in that by July of 2020, it was sort of back to normal. And, and it's just, you did what you could get away with. But beyond that, it was sort of doing it. I went back and looked at my calendar to see if there was what was my big activity. And I went to Kat Timpf's wedding reception. It was my first, at a speakeasy hotel in New York with all the youths being all youthful and without their masks and stuff. I was already doing things. Eric asks.
With a K?
No, it's with a C. Okay. Not a CK, which is the best. As we all know, I fondly remember as a child, as the Christmas season approached, my mother would drop on the coffee table the Christmas catalogs from all the department stores. Can we guess Eric's age? I know. I would spend an
evening. I think he's still living with his mom, though.
I would spend an evening with a red marker circling the items I wanted, then turning that into a written Santa list of my very favorites. Didn't take long before the reality of the Santa falsehood to become apparent.
That's
speaking
jarring.
Of therapy, this
yeah.
is
yeah, yeah, yeah. This is
of the question on the wind up. What would be at the top of your Santa list of things that you would like changed in American government and or politics, Catherine?
That was a very Matt Welsh question. It was like, where's this going to go? And it's to me. I think it's just, could we please stop spending all the money? Like, it's a not doing a thing request, which frankly, I think a lot of things on my real Christmas list would be like, could people please stop doing things? But you know, you never get those under the tree, sadly. There's this sort of like little mini industry in like forums where they ask you how we're going to fix democracy that I've like done many of over the years. And my answer to those is typically some version of like, could we be nicer to each other? Like, could we find ways to be nicer to each other? Which is essentially a concern about polarization. Like, I do think, as I've said on the podcast, that is a thing that has always been bad, but is sort of a slightly different and worse form of bad than it was before. So I guess what I'm arguing for is more dinner parties inside my house where it's warm. Stop spending the money. Like, we are super duper out of money. Like, wow, are we out of money? Like
but we just keep making more.
Like, the inflation is like lurking behind us, and the fact that seems to matter not at all to the people in charge in Washington continues to kind of shock and surprise me even after all these years.
It's like a column still, but for money, right? You just sort of keep putting more in, and then whiskey just comes out the other, or like a Solera system,
yeah, it's
like,
exactly.
But that makes something good, and this money does not.
Nick, you're haunted by the death of Santa.
I thought we were going to talk about catalogs growing up as a kid, because I can tell you that when the Sears Wish Book would come around once a year, and it was this fat phone book, and I realize already I'm talking in double things that most people don't remember.
Yeah.
But
a New York City
phone book, fat, yellow and white pages together of everything that was available from Sears. And the great things there, Matt, and you'll appreciate this, were that you could get any NFL team, any Major League Baseball team, any NBA team. They would have the uniforms or the shirts, the merch
pajamas
for those teams, which, you know, you were always subjected to whatever shitty metro area you lived in. And I grew up when, the Jets and the Giants sucked, and the Yankees and the Mets sucked, and that was like all you could choose from. You know, so that was when I started thinking about superabundance without thinking about that. That's, I want to live in a world where, you know, you could purchase any NFL team.
Cross state lines.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah,
purchase some Vikings gear.
And like, you know, you should be able to purchase health insurance, you know.
Speaking of health insurance, what's your big one, Santa?
Oh, my big catalog is Musician's Friend from the 1990s, which I spent hours and hours poring over, like learning the details of every amp and analog 8-track system that was sold on the market in 1998. And then I became me. This is a stretch goal, as they say, but it's transform all of the universal old age entitlements into targeted benefits for the poor and special needs people, right? Mm-hmm. And to do it over time, I'm not saying like, I actually would not, even if I could choose to do this like tomorrow, I think that would be a bad idea. It would be bad for the polity, but to like set a date some number of years from now and to no longer have Medicare or Social Security as we know them, but instead to have programs that benefit people who have clear needs that are demonstrated, and to make our social spending about that. And that would, in a lot of ways, solve Catherine's problem of spending all the money.
Good. Yeah. We're asking for the same present.
I would just channel my inner Clark Neely and say, end coercive plea bargains.
Hmm. That's very specific. Mm. Potentially
or
doable.
Do you have a legal issue that we're going to be learning about in the new year, Matt?
Yeah. speaking of which, donate to Reason so that we can pay for Matt's legal defense.
Oh, no.
Luke, another great name. I always like, if we were going to have a boy, I was always arguing for Luke. Luke Welch, that's a good name.
Luke Welch is very good.
It's like a mouthful. I don't know.
I like
middle name Skywalker.
Male names that are one syllable.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Not lots of nice words about podcast. Luke donated today.
Hey, thanks, Luke.
Wow. So this is why Luke got to the front of the line.
Luke donated a kidney to Reason Foundation.
That's right.
We don't think you should have to donate a kidney. We want him to be able to sell his kidney on the free market.
It was his choice,
and then give us the money.
Who are we to judge?
We prefer that.
Luke is thanking us for the excellent podcast. First visit to Reason.com when Eugene Volokh and his co-conspirators came over to your site. Like 5 years ago?
Been a while.
Sounds like it.
And since then, I've been consuming more and more of your catalog. Mm. Blah, blah, blah. My question,
better than musician's friend.
My question is about libertarianism's place in the broader liberal coalition. I think of libertarianism as a fundamental liberal ideology and wish that I could more easily convey that idea to my non-libertarian friends and colleagues on the left. They see libertarianism as a far-right ideology, even though many libertarians, myself included, have more in common with those on the left than on the right. So my question is, am I wrong? Does libertarianism have a place in the modern liberal coalition? What is the elevator pitch for libertarianism as a liberal or left ideology, Catherine?
I think that the pitch, at least, is to kind of start with what we have in common with people who conventionally identify as left in the United States, which is, personal kind of individual freedom, including sexual freedom, freedom to do what you want to do with your body, opposition to the war on drugs, opposition to the overwhelming size and scope of our criminal justice apparatus. Like, those all seem like good places to start. But then I actually think, like, in some ways, the way to go is to just rip off the Band-Aid on the places where we really typically disagree with the left and to say, I know that you are skeptical of capitalism and markets, but let me tell you why I think they help the poor. Like, I know that in some ways, like, that is an argument that people should have heard, but I genuinely think that maybe they haven't yet. And to have it come from someone that they know or trust can really be useful. And then we actually have a piece in the upcoming issue by Jacob Sullum, which is about gun control and about how if you oppose the war on drugs, because at least in part because you think it has racially disparate outcomes and has origins in racist ideology, then you should also oppose gun control for those same reasons. And I think, like, the two boogeymen of libertarianism for the left are guns and capitalism. So just, like, get in there and try to talk about it in language that people on the left can understand.
I think pistol whipping them with your gun
that
you
bought,
that your Second Amendment approved gun is also a pretty convincing argument.
Or work with the blackjack.
A blackjack is nice, and in many states they're not regulated. I would also think it's worth pointing out, libertarianism or classical liberalism, 19th century liberalism, is the original liberal position. And as Catherine was talking about, it was a shift of power from, hierarchy, authoritarian, tyrannical powers, inherited powers, to people, things being devolved to the individual. And it's worth understanding that free market economics or capitalism is the economic application of that principle to one sphere of human activity, but it's not the overwhelming one. But liberals and leftists, and this is more true and is going to become more and more true over the coming years, are very distinct beasts. Most liberals, most Democrats, if you think about somebody like a Bill Clinton or even a Hillary Clinton circa 2000, they agreed that markets were really good at producing more stuff and delivering more stuff to more people. They are not Bernie Sanders leftists who hate capitalism, who hate markets, who hate prices, who hate entrepreneurs and stuff like that. So we actually have so much in common with liberals to say, you know what, like, Amazon is pretty fucking great. And wasn't it better to have it during the pandemic than not? We shouldn't be throwing that out, as well as then talking about various kinds of social issues. And that idea that, you know what, the best world is where individuals can get along peacefully with each other. And libertarianism, I think, and liberalism properly understood, provides that scaffolding. It's, you know, it's the operating system for a society where lots of people can run their personal life applications without crashing the system. That's the goal. Let's kind of focus on that.
You know what's one thing this person could do? They could donate $100 to Reason's webathon that we're having right now, and you get a free digital subscription. And maybe they could give that subscription to their friends.
I mean, doing the frenemy subscription is very important. Suderman, do you have anything to add to that?
I would just add that the way that one of the ways that Reason engages with liberalism and even with the left, I think, is just through our coverage in particular of criminal justice and police abuse. And we hit that note every single day and every single week. And that is something that we do specifically just to sort of remind people that we are opposed to state power in all of its forms.
And I do relish the grudging tweets that we get sometimes from people about it. Like on the regular, we will get a tweet that's like, say what you want about the mean adjective people at Reason. They are consistent on police abuse, criminal justice, whatever. Like that means more to me than the people who agree with us generally. That, like the people who also hate it that we do this well.
I think that also gets to the distinction between liberals and progressives. And I when I joined Reason in 93, this was like a big bugaboo of mine, and it's just gotten worse. Liberals don't really care about criminal justice that much. I'm not saying that they should, but they don't really care, you know, whereas like people on the left really care about that kind of stuff. And I think liberals, the sweet spot is going to be more things like, you know, you look at the way markets work, you know, because they tend to be friendly to markets. They're not inimical. And then you kind of show that capitalism is regulating itself pretty well, and it actually needs less regulation than you think. And if you believe in things like free speech, because liberals are opposed to identity politics, progressives are going in that direction. There's a lot of good overlap there.
Let's go to a round of individualized questions.
Peter, could I, before we do that, could I get a splash of your Freedom Press coffee? Thank you. Oh, that's
maybe I want some of that too.
We're just having a coffee break?
We're not breaking. We're going. This is live, man.
You know, and it's Folgers crystals. That's what you're telling me?
You're soaking in it.
Yeah. Can't believe it.
This comes to Dr. Nick Gillespie from Michael Murmack. From
Michael
Folsom.
Murmack. What a false name. It's just made up. It sounds made up.
The question below is primarily for Dr. Nick Gillespie. Many cultures have national epics, literary compositions that illustrate the sense of life and typical character of a people. For example, Iranians have the Book of Kings, Shahnameh, and Estonians have Cayley's Son, and I'm not going to pronounce that word. Number one, as a doctor of literature, does the U.S. have a national epic that sums up the individualist or libertarian character of Americans? You cannot mention de Tocqueville.
Yeah.
Number two, can the rest of the...
I wouldn't want to.
Well, the rest of the panel, we don't need that. Yeah. Let's hear Nick.
I wouldn't mention Tocqueville. He's, you know, the most overrated figure in American letters. Absolutely. Democracy in America is kind of interesting, but, you know, what do... Just like Bernard Henri Lévy.
Special edition.
Bernard Henri Lévy, you know, like French people know and represent, you know, they understand very little about America. And when they come here, they're almost always wrong. Having said that, my personal take on this kind of stuff is that the literary genre that kind of defines America for a variety of reasons is the autobiography or the memoir. And it's partly because it's individualistic by nature. And I would say that the books to me that I go back to on a regular basis that really I find fascinating and kind of tell, they're the DNA of a lot of things in America, are the captivity narrative of Mary Rowlandson, who is a colonial settler who was captured by Indians and then has a bunch of weird and interesting adventures. And she's writing for an English audience during an English Civil War. Fantastic. And that actually is one of the first great works that was written or experienced in America, although it was published in London. The autobiography of Ben Franklin, which is just a phenomenally complicated. He's not a saint by any stretch, but his whole thing is he's writing to his son, who would later become the last colonial governor of New Jersey, who he would be estranged from because of the revolution. And he said, I want to show you how I made my way in the world. And it's like the first how-to book. And it's about an individual getting on his way. And it's just deep and wonderful. And then in that in that frame of kind of genre or whatever, the autobiographies of Frederick Douglass. There's three versions of them. But again, he has in that line, I choke up thinking about it. You have seen how I was made a slave. Now I will tell you how I became a man. And that is another great work of self-creation, self-innovation. It's warm, it's empathic, it's deeply moving. And it's also fundamentally about capitalism. His move from a slave economy to a free labor economy in the North is one of the great moments in that book. And it's also one that current champions of Frederick Douglass and identity politics in the 1619 Project always have to explain away. And in my doctoral dissertation, I treated Douglass a bit. There were critics, and this was in the late 80s, early 90s, when late capitalism was first becoming a real thing, right? Because people thought the Soviet Union was going to win. But people would be like, you know, it is a shame that Douglass, for all of his wisdom and insight, that he didn't understand when he left the South and moved to the North and became like a ship caulker in Massachusetts, that he was merely trading one form of slavery for another, meaning making money and keeping it for the work that you do. So those books are great. The other thing that I would say, and we talked about this in the 35th anniversary issue of Reason, where we had 35 Heroes of Freedom, the Little House books are a fantastic, they're in a bad odor now because they were canceled because of some passages that were dubbed negative or disparaging towards Native Americans, which is a misinterpretation of the book. But that series is an incredible counter revisionist way of talking about how America was settled, which is by families, not by weirdo, rugged individualist mountain men like, you know, Natty Bumppo, who go out and, you know, tame the wilderness and then we follow. So I would say those things are the things I look towards.
Can I make a suggestion here? Yeah. That's not a book and not an autobiography of any kind, but in fact, the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
No!
And I am not kidding here. I'm not kidding at all. These are all stories of self-formation.
Yeah.
Right? It starts out being about billionaires and nerds and inventors and scientists and soldiers. And eventually it becomes also about women and minorities and immigrants and people from other freaking planets and crazy raccoons and just all of the kind of deep weirdness of humanity and even the things that are extra human, right? And it's about people who become heroic individuals and who are constantly struggling both to be good and to be themselves, because that is the same struggle. And that seems to me in some ways like the American struggle.
Oh my God.
That's not bad. I'm halfway there with that. I thought you were going to say The Godfather.
I think Frederick Douglass has put you in like a empathetic mood.
Yeah, Frederick Douglass is he's definitely a superhero. But the one that people aren't that familiar with is the captivity narrative, Mary Rowlandson, and it's freaking awesome.
So this is directed at Catherine. So this comes from John Buck. It's the name of one of my best baseball coaches, by the way, John Buck. It's probably not the same person. Though a magazine with libertarian leanings could never become as ineffective and as useless as the FDA, an outsider might get the impression Reason's very own bureaucratic structure. You firing shots here, John Buck? Isn't as forward-thinking as they could be. Sure, you're writers and thinkers as opposed to business people, but the wonderful thing about capitalism is those who think outside the box will normally be rewarded in kind. He's getting around to the question, I swear. Let's see. We have a monthly print, an e-zine edition of Reason, a YouTube channel, as well as roundtable interview and Soho Forum debate podcasts that produce, on average, one show per week. All trend lines point to digital growth. Why not produce a daily roundtable podcast with panels comprised of other writers on the staff, a few of whom already do fill-in work when vacations are taken? The more content you provide means the more ads that can be placed. The more ads placed, the more revenue you have coming in. I'm not going to hold my breath for a Reason streaming channel. Still a great idea. But the point still stands. The more content you put out there, the more people you reach. Catherine, what do you say about that?
You're right. And, you know, I think this is a great time to remind everyone who is watching or listening to this podcast that to support more great Reason content, they should donate to our webathon.
Do we have anything that we'd like to sort of tease to the webathon donors and listeners and viewers and readers of Reason content about stuff that we're going to be producing in the future?
Yeah. So we, in fact, are going to be growing some of our podcast offerings. So you can take credit for this, John Buck. You can say that this was all your idea. But we are hopefully going to be debuting a few new pods in the next year or so. You can, of course, also get a little more Reason content on your Instagrams and your Twitters, where we have been putting more stuff. And
are we doing dance-offs on TikTok
saying
yet?
Saying that TikTok is a thing, but maybe TikTok is a thing. So yes, more Reason content coming your way. And again, I love that. No.
Yep. Okay, so we're not doing TikTok, it seems.
I love that
epileptic seizures
people
on TikTok
continue to really believe that like advertising revenue is a big part of our budget. And it is. It does matter. But the thing that actually matters is donations.
Yes.
Tax-deductible
donations to our 501c3.
Three. I don't know why I blanked on that the other day. This one goes to Suderman, who I understand has a bonus newsletter about cocktails. So this would seem appropriate. David, Denver. Thanks in part to your excellent article, How Government Killed the Cocktail. Yes, that was an excellent article. Along with the discovery of bars like the Dead Rabbit in New York and Death & Co. in my hometown of Denver, I've become pretty particular when it comes to my drinking, says David. Do you, Peter Suderman, have an approach to deciding if ordering a cocktail at a particular establishment will be worth it? I find that diamonds in the rough seem to be few and far between, and premium prices rarely mean premium cocktails. So I rarely take the gamble anymore if I haven't done prior research. Was curious if there are things you look for at an establishment to see if their cocktails may be worth trying.
Yeah, so that is, you have already discovered the first thing that you discover about like expensive cocktails is that the fact that they are expensive does not make them good. Neither does weird ingredients or like goofy looking, you know, whole forest garnishes. Even if somebody has spent a whole lot of time like constructing an elaborate, you know, a whole new rainforest to solve global warming on top of your drink, that does not make the underlying cocktail good. So I think that the most important thing is to do research and to become familiar with the bars that are highly regarded in any city that you happen to be going to. Death & Company in Denver is, of course, a great bar. Death & Company in New York is my favorite bar in the world. I've learned a lot from them and from their books. But I would say that if you don't know in advance, the two things that you can look for are craft, which is just to say, how are the bartenders putting together the drinks? Are they measuring precisely? Are they stirring in a way that seems to be consistent? Shaking in a way that is consistent? Are they shaking more than just sort of one lazy like, shake, right? Like Catherine occasionally asks me to analyze a shake at a bar, and I will like deliver like a paragraph review of the bartender's shake and what it tells you about the likely quality of the cocktails. This is a thing that you can learn to do, especially if you've learned to make these drinks on your own. The other thing that you can look for is the bar conversant in the classics? So do they have Manhattans on the menu? Order one. Is it any good? If they can't make a good Manhattan or a good old fashioned or a good martini, whatever your choice of classic is, then they are not going to be able to make other cocktails well.
But at that point, you've already spent. So do you beat the check? Do you run out or do you fake a heart attack
well,
or
at that
take
point,
a call outside and then just
one
never come
drink
back?
As a sort of R&D on the bar, and you know, you sometimes take the loss.
Sometimes I just see Suderman like quietly drinking a beer in a bar, and that is like the sickest burn. Like it's just like if you're in a bar that has a cocktail menu and the cocktails have like names and stuff, and Suderman is like just holding a beer. Whew. Ouch.
I look for bartenders who can make cocktails by throwing bottles high up into the air, Tom Cruise and Cocktail while dancing the hippie shake.
Yeah. Are they dancing on the bar? Because that is a sign
that's
of quality.
Awesome. Yeah.
Let's go to some libertarian red meat questions. Matt B from College Station, Texas, right?
Yeah. Lived fairly close to College Station when I lived in Huntsville, Texas, home of the Sam Houston State Bearcats with a K.
The Death Factory.
Yeah.
Is the Free State Project all it is advertised to be, Catherine? And why isn't it more of a mainstream libertarian talking point?
So I think the Free State Project in some ways is what it was advertised to be. I think people wanted more from it than what it was advertised to be, if that makes sense. So I did not sign on to the Free State Project. Again, see previous comments about hating to be cold. But I have gone to Porkfest, which is their kind of annual festival gathering, whatever. And it is delightful. Like just a bunch of like weirdos in skirts with like their AR-15 selling you drugs. Like it's just what you imagine. It's just incredible.
All background characters from a Guardians of the Galaxy film.
100%. And so in that sense, I think like building that community has been a success. There was always going to be very high attrition. For those who don't know, the Free State Project's idea was that people signed a pledge that once a certain threshold was reached, they would all move to New Hampshire and kind of take over whatever amount of the government there they could and make a libertarian utopia. That has not happened, but I do think you can see, among other things, in the backlash from normies in like Keene and other places there, they have had some success. I think I actually originally learned this from Brian Doherty, that people go around feeding the parking meters to prevent the government from getting parking ticket money. Like that's like a cultural norm in some places in New Hampshire. So, you know, maybe it's just that I have modest ambitions for any project that seeks to fix things via government mechanisms. I think that those very, very rarely work in any form. But the Free State Project, you know, it's actually, I think it's similar to crypto, it's similar to Bitcoin, in that it is just an idea that someone had and wrote a paper about that did become a thing in the world. And so I give them credit for that.
Yeah, that is cool. And there's always going to be, I mean, the number of libertarians in the country, it's hard, depends on how you measure it, sometimes sort of 5%, 15%, whatever. But the number of people who self-identify as libertarians enough to move to New Hampshire, it's not going to be a million people. So it's just one of many things. And it's nice. We're friendly. Let's take this one to Nick. This comes from Jim from Brooklyn. Hello, crew. Let's talk 2024 presidential elections.
So he's an optimist.
Let's suppose that the Dems go with either Biden or Harris, the Republicans go once again with Trump, and the Libertarians nominate Justin Amash. In that scenario, what do you think are the odds for a stunning or not very stunning Libertarian victory? What other scenarios do you envision in 2024 that could put the LP in position as true contenders for the top job or any other political jobs that rank higher than, say, becoming a constable in Pennsylvania? What are the odds there could be some kind of Republican breakup between Trumpies and more liberty-oriented non-Trumpies, and what would that mean for the LP?
Being serious about this for a minute, I would put, if it's Amash versus Biden versus Trump, I would say, you know, the chances of him winning are between 95 and 99%. He would be fantastic. I think he is, from a political perspective, he is the absolute best person who has been involved in libertarian politics ever. And this is not to short sheet people like Gary Johnson, people like Ed Clark, people like Harry Brown, whatever, you know, whoever you want to talk about. Ron Paul, certainly. But Amash is the real package for any number of reasons. I think if that's the scenario, I think it's highly likely that a libertarian candidate with a well-run presidential run would get 10% easily, because the lack of interest in Trump and the lack of support for Biden is large and growing. These are old men who represent two worn out, shitty ideals of what politics can do, what the Republican Party or the Democratic Party can do. I hope that they face off again, because this is, you know, will be the third time, at least the third time in a row, where the parties are saying, please kill us. And I think, but what has to go along with that, because, you know, Matt, you and I obviously have written about this at length and whatnot, what has to go along with it is a positive vision of what a libertarian form of government at the national level would look like. And I think Amash brings that, because it's based on autonomy, it's based on empathy, it's based on real, on actually constraining the size, scope, and spending of government according to principles that we've all agreed to, you know, at various points in our history. And I would love, and Amash looks like the future of America. He's the son of immigrants. He's multi-ethnic. He is both religious and fiercely, non-traditional in the way that he goes about things. And he's mostly interested, you know, to go back to what Peter was talking about earlier, he's interested, you know, that government should help the people who need help. They don't have to help the rest of us. If we're doing okay, we can get on with our lives, and we should pay less in taxes and be regulated less, and then we can funnel real meaningful help to people. So I think it would be fantastic. I don't have any sense of whether or not Amash is going to run. I don't know if you guys have. He's kind of gone dark, you know, in terms of a lot of his ambition.
Like spiritually? Or
I wish. No, yeah. He hasn't been talking, or it hasn't been as public about this kind of stuff. And there is a real civil war going on in the Libertarian Party, which needs it, because the Libertarian Party has not been, you know, for a party that's been around for 50 years, it's kind of going sideways for a while. So, you know, there's the Mises Caucus people, there's people like Amash, there's more traditional type people, you know, like something has to happen. And I hope that Amash emerges as a viable third party candidate for the Libertarian Party.
I will agree with you that if it is Biden versus Trump versus Amash, that that is the maximalist position, I think, for a Libertarian Party, because people don't like Trump except for the people who do. And I don't know if anyone actually likes Biden anymore.
But no, there's like, you know, they're like against a third Trump. that are diehards for these idiots. And that translates into, you know, 45-49% for each of them in an election, unless there's somebody like Justin Amash, who is really energetic, powerful, thoughtful, ideologically, you know, oriented towards the future.
I think the chances of that being the three-way race are not very high. Even though Trump has still a lot of sway in the party, I think there will be a genuine contest. I think Democrats are already like, oh boy.
But they have to, the Democrats also have to get rid of two people, because there's two dead bodies in the White House right now, or right in Washington. There's him and Harris. And nobody in the Democratic Party who wants to win the 2024 election is like, yeah, we got to go with Harris.
It's not happening. Let us go. Speaking of Justin Amash and science fiction.
Were we?
We weren't. But I was
thinking about it.
I will say
that the scenario in which the Libertarian Party wins a presidential election is indeed science fiction.
No, Amash and his brother are absolutely ridiculous Star Trek nerds. Mm. Yeah. I think it's Next Generation is their jam. I don't know what that means. But
the one that came out in the 1980s and starred my captain, Jean-Luc Picard.
Okay, so here's a question from...
He's not even American.
Faithful listener and correspondent Leonard Goodnight. If that is your real name.
God, again, these people come up with better pseudonyms.
If the Roundtablers were a Star Trek bridge crew, who would hold what positions and what species would you all be? Obviously, Peter has to answer this question.
So I'll start with myself, just because I've been thinking about this.
Did you feel the weight of like the wind up, like the preparation
let's look at the notes over there.
I blacked out because the oxygen left the room.
Do it. Go ahead. Sorry.
As for myself, like in some ways, I feel like I'm kind of like Riker, right? Like sort of takes orders, grows a beard in the middle of like, you know, season four, sometimes shows up with a trombone. Like, oh, okay, yeah. Right. But I also feel a lot on this podcast, at least, like Geordi LaForge. And actually, maybe more than that, I feel like LeVar Burton reading the scripts that were handed him, because I don't know if you guys know this about how Star Trek The Next Generation scripts were written.
We don't.
Yes.
But there was a lot of like techno babble on this show, right? The tachyon emitters were always out of phase, except the writers wouldn't write the tachyon emitters are out of phase. They would just write two brackets and then the word tech in between them, and the science advisor would have to come in and fill in like, no, it's the tachyon emitters again.
Of course.
Right? And I feel like my role on this podcast is often just like, Matt, you're like, Peter, tech. So I kind of feel like Geordi LaForge.
Who was the guy with the horseshoe crab on his forehead?
Worf.
Thank you.
You mean the Klingon? So I don't know who the Klingon is here, but I do think...
The Klingon is our audio producer,
yeah.
Ian.
No, that's actually absolutely correct.
Who promised me a can of tactical bacon if I said that on this podcast. I will be collecting.
What is tactical bacon?
I don't know. Don't you want to know?
You know, open it in a field by yourself, okay?
It's just don't open it in the bacon office. That's a weapon, or it's bacon that can be used after all the weapons are out of bullets, and either way, it's great.
So I think Nick actually here is Q. He's not a member of the main cast. He is simply the most interesting supporting character who comes to he like shows up on the bridge. He's a godlike alien being who shows up on the bridge to like taunt the captain And also make some really good points at the same time, and wear goofy costumes, and sometimes there's a mariachi band involved. It's always wonderful when John Delancey shows up. I think Matt Welch here is not from The Next Generation, but Matt Welch is from the original series, and you are Dr. McCoy. You are
Bones.
You are Bones. Yep.
Crack my knuckles and jump for joy.
You are. You've got that sort of.
I'm not that cranky.
You've got that cranky, exasperated vibe. But you also like are a crucial part.
He's Kirk. He's 100% Bill Shatner.
I'm not making out with everybody.
No, and I think I here know, we have both Kirk and Picard in the form of Captain Picard,
but not the lady captain.
Nobody likes the lady captain. I learned.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, why not? Because she's a lady.
We probably the sexism. Yeah. No, we previously explored this question. Y'all may remember when Freedom Fest was Star Trek themed, and there was a brief period where we seriously considered acquiring Star Trek costumes and appearing on stage as various characters. Yeah. Luckily, that did not occur, and I think we can all agree that was for the best.
I want to make a pitch. He's not on the bridge in any of the shows, but the Gorn. I want to be the Gorn. You know, the Gorn is this lizard-type creature that basically spends half an episode getting pelted by large styrofoam boulders by William Shatner in the San Fernando Valley.
In the greatest fight scene ever filmed. You should just Google it. Star Trek Gorn fight scene.
Yeah.
Kirk has a move in which he balls his two hands into like a rock over his head and tries to smash the Gorn's head. And you're like, that's not fighting. I don't know what that is, but it doesn't like.
But it worked. It ultimately works.
That was a 70s fight in TV. Yeah. Bad TV
you were
shows.
Always you hitting people. He does something similar with Khan as well. Yeah. But the fight scene between Gorn and Kirk also eerily anticipates Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman in Zaire. It's almost the same. It's almost step by step. It's a complete ripoff.
She's not here today, but she is a recurring guest on this podcast. So I will just say that Stephanie Slade is obviously Spock.
That's true.
Obviously.
Since we already started this, and since I know at least one of us have spent a lot of time, maybe all four, rehearsing or researching this question. This comes from Molly. What three fictional characters describe you? Three. Nick, you've obviously come up with it.
I really was totally stymied by this, and I had a quick confab with people I used to respect just before this podcast.
Well, you didn't
to
talk
get
to
ideas.
Me, yeah.
Well, like I said, Matt, I used to respect. Yeah. Okay, so maybe I still respect you, or maybe I never respect you.
Those
you can
the
go
options.
Either way. So I don't have any good answers for this. I did one of the Game of Thrones quizzes that Catherine suggested that we look at, and I turned out to be, of course, Peter Dinklage from Game of Thrones, and I think that's a pretty tight fit. I have been likened to, the Fonzie. I'm the free market Fonzie. Yeah. I feel like that, especially because I jumped the shark sometime in the early 80s when the Happy Days crew was running a dude farm out in a dude ranch out in California. To be a little bit more pompous, I like to one of my favorite characters. Yeah, thank you. In literature is the Hickey character in the Eugene O'Neill The Iceman Cometh, because it's set in a bar. I think I've mentioned this because Donald Trump, I figured as a Hickey character, set in a bar where there's a bunch of barflies who are all sitting around just drinking all the time, talking about how when things get right, they're going to do all of these incredible dreams. And this traveling salesman named Hickey, who was originally played by Jason Robards Jr., comes in and he disabuses them. The play, which is about 10 hours long, he just spends time destroying each of their dreams by saying, like, you're never going to do that, and et cetera. And then he is revealed. And because the play is, 100 years old, I feel safe ruining it for people. But then it is revealed at the end that Hickey, who is himself a major boosad, has murdered his wife and maybe a couple of other people and gets hauled off. And so exit the scene. And I have a lot of empathy for Hickey. I like the way that he forces people to be realistic about themselves. Hopefully you can do that in a way that actually empowers people to do their dreams. And then he's revealed as, as bad as the rest of them, actually worse.
This folds in with my obvious go-to with Nick is he's the No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, Anton Chigurh. Yeah.
Catherine, what are your answers to this question?
Another agent of chaos like you.
Yeah.
So the reason staff a while back took the like an online what fictional character are you quiz like collectively, this is my greatest temptation as a manager. I would make people take like all manner of personality tests, except for that I recognize that
so
they would
hate
Briggs
Meyer. It's
any,
like
all of them, any of them. Like I just love that stuff, even though
what's
I know
your Enneagram?
Mostly bullshit. And
which Nazi from Hogan's Heroes are you
not
most
the
like?
BuzzFeed ones, the pseudoscientific ones. That's my jam. And on this quiz, I do come up as Olenna Tyrell, which y'all may remember from Game of Thrones as the old lady who in the end says, like, I want her to know it was me. Like the really
that's Diana Rigg.
The mean mastermind old lady, which feels right to me. Other results on this quiz that I got include Hermione Granger, sorry to say, but that's just the truth.
That's not bad.
And Mycroft Holmes, Sherlock Holmes's
smarter
brother who's smarter, but who prefers to work from the chair. He doesn't like to do the legwork and is perhaps the British government. And then also every lady CEO in all of TV. Like, you name them, they came up in my top 10. Like, and it's you know what?
Who
like,
are
it
the
is,
lady CEOs?
It is
on
what
TV.
It is. Like, we got the Shiv Roys, the Olivia Pope, Charlotte Hale from Westworld.
Okay. That's pretty good.
All of the sort of sinister lady CEOs. In the Marvel Universe.
You're not sinister.
Thank you. That's what you have to say, or I'll kill you.
Yeah.
In
you
could
see him sweating while he's saying that.
I get
unbuttoning down to BHL level.
Doctor Strange is the Marvel Universe result that I get.
Wow. Are you a secret watch guy?
You're Lady Loki. We've covered that.
I'm just saying that's not what showed up on
the quiz. I think you should go deep on the whole Diana Rigg. Her character.
I mean, her
because,
whole
like, from
oeuvre,
the Avengers.
I accept every character.
So great.
I will say that my Star Trek result, which I don't know what it means, is Jadzia Dax.
Ooh. So Jadzia Dax is. Jadzia Dax is a host parasite situation in which like a little worm thing goes into a new body every like 80 or 90 years. And sometimes the worm thing goes into a man and sometimes it goes into a woman. But it's like it could be either at any point is sort of the point here. And there's there's sort of a duality to it because the host also changes the personality each time. She's got super cool neck tattoos.
Yes.
I think, Matt, you as a Star Trek person, you are Charlie X. Peter, do you remember who Charlie X is from the original series?
Wait, is that the one who turned out to be Jack the Ripper?
No. Charlie X is a man who is actually has the mind of a child and then gets very angry all the time.
That,
and like in one famous scene, it's the only reason to watch the original series, to be quite honest. Is he gets
that
mad at a woman in a blue mini dress?
I think we're
and she turns around and she doesn't have a face anymore.
Reminder
he
that
doesn't
this is
she
the
doesn't
reason,
have a face anymore.
The reason Webathon.
And she gets
we
pulled out. He gets
reason.
Pulled out by
you
his
donate to Reason. Speaking of cool neck tattoos, if you give
played
us $50,
Robert Walker
you're
Jr.
Just still talking. If you give us $50, you get a temporary tattoo with the Reason logo, and it's pretty cool. So you could.
I'll just say that Charlie X is better than Malcolm X, but they're both revolutionary.
I want to cast Matt and Nick as Zaphod Breebelbrox from
How Dare You, Sir?
Galaxy.
How dare you?
Kind of like he's a two-headed con man who is occasionally the president of the galaxy, but usually not.
I very much feel like the Trillion Deer Zaphods sometimes, guys.
I don't know what these people are talking about.
But you
Peter,
do like the thing with two heads, right?
Oh,
the Rosie Grier, Ray Milland movie from the early 70s.
Guys, come on. Get it together.
On.
Rosie Grier taught us one important thing in life, and that it's all right to cry. Peter, you have 10 seconds to say which three characters you are in.
My top character on that quiz that everybody took was Varys from Game of Thrones, who I'll just let you all figure out what you think of that. I would just note that the top 10 character across the Reason staff was Ian Malcolm from Jurassic Park, and I really think that's accurate. Like, there is a huge amount of Ian Malcolm DNA in the Reason staff.
Which, who is he?
Life.
That's the Jeff,
Jeff Goldblum character. Yeah, sure.
The rock star scientist.
Yeah. Who's working it out in, like, real time.
Who speaks in jazz.
Yeah.
I obviously identify the most in the world of fiction with the dude from The Big Lebowski. Like, it's always been an aspirational situation with me, just fashion and musical taste. But I took the dumb quiz and I turned out to be Remy from Ratatouille.
Yes.
Oh my God. Is that the rat or the guy?
It's the rat. Because he wants to be a chef. All he wants to do is be a chef.
Well, he has a dream.
Yeah.
To be great at his craft. And also he likes French ladies.
Oh, and he's a rat. All right, let's try to get some quick policy under the deadline here.
Now that we've covered the good stuff.
My question is this: following the George Floyd protests and BLM movement in 2020, there was a moment where criminal justice and policing reform seemed imminent. Has that moment been snuffed out for good? Or is it closer to a Matt Welch mixed metaphor where the flame still burns on a twisted ocean of rocky shores? I don't see the problem with that. Specifically, what could end qualified immunity, one of the worst precedents in our criminal justice system? Catherine.
I am a little pessimistic at the moment, but I think that this is probably, hopefully this is the sort of thing that the idea has been planted. The seed has been planted in the rocky shores, and it's winter now, but the seed will bloom again in the spring when conditions are better. And so maybe this is, we've sort of made some steps in the right direction across the ocean of despair.
Most of the stuff happens locally. Most new administrations work on their big one, two or three things at the beginning, and that's all they pay attention to. When all those stop, then maybe they'll pay more attention federally, and hopefully they will get that qualified immunity.
This is also a good, I mean, qualified immunity should go, obviously. Police unions should be broken in various ways. But this is also a good example of where custom is more important than law. The laws on the books will take forever to change, but I think police are acting more circumspectly and people are demanding more, and that, you know, we are seeing a difference in the way that people go about their business because of all of the attention that's been called to this.
All right. This question is very important. Comes from Joseph Hinshaw. What's your favorite Reason Rat joke? I should say at Reason Rat. It's a Twitter account. And what's the story behind it?
There is no such thing as a Reason Rat joke. They are all just real things that were said by a Reason staffer.
Occasionally it's slacked.
Or slacked by a Reason staffer. The account is manned by an anonymous person. We do not know who the Reason Rat is.
Has there been an attempt to smoke?
There probably, but it's the Reason Rat's
Pierre Delicto.
Anonymity remains secure, but you can follow it on Twitter and hear the nonsense things that we say. They are mostly just like delightfully out of context quotes. But the story behind it is that our office was infested with rats, and it still is a little. And if that's not a reason to donate to the webathon, I really don't know what is. We are in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. We have a very cool historic building, and man, we got rats. We got a lot of rats, including one that was once discovered inside our coffee maker. Please give us
that. Yeah, that was the ultimate.
There's a reason some of us work in New York City.
Oh, yeah. A delightfully rat-free place. You literally came up with Remy on your test results. Don't be snippy.
You're so self-hating, man.
This one probably can be bounced between Peter and Catherine, although I'm sure Nick has things to say as well. From Aaron, would you recommend any writers or other resources for analyzing science fiction through a libertarian lens? I love to hear from y'all how Asimov's Foundation novels, which I've loved since I was a teen, reflect a monstrous, technocratic, borderline totalitarian view of the world. And I want to hear more.
Can we talk about Asimov for a minute, Peter?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. Asking you that was like
so
a sure thing.
So that means you need to keep it short. No, I'm just saying for a minute, because you guys will talk for hours.
We'll talk for hours. I actually think it is true that Asimov's vision is monstrous and totalizing, but that it is not, it does not present that sort of totalitarian world as a pure utopia, that a lot of his stories are about the ways that centralizing and automating things that were once human and messy will not totally work out. My favorite Isaac Asimov short story, which I think I've talked about before, it's called Franchise, and it's was probably inspired by the fact that the famous real computer UNIVAC correctly predicted the 1952 presidential election. And so Asimov wrote a short story about future elections in which a single human is brought in sort of asked a bunch of questions just to build in human irrationality to the result. And then Multivac, who was Asimov's kind of supercomputer, determines the outcome of the election. And I think that, like, that to 13-year-old me blew my mind, like, immediately explains a lot about politics. Probably there's a straight line from that story to my views that you should not vote today. And it's a classic Asimov in that it is monstrous and totalitarian, but it also shows the ways in which that world misses the mark, or sort of, you know, has a hole at the center of it. In terms of resources, I would just say Libertarian Futurist Society, which gives out Prometheus Awards every year, a great way to just, like, build up your libertarian science fiction reading list.
I would just say read biographies of your favorite writers, because the biographies, even if they are critical, even if they are not focused on the writer's politics, they will inevitably cover some of those political influences. And the fractious political nature of writing science fiction in the 1900s in the United States, because all of those folks were involved in science fiction political societies, or political societies that became science fiction societies, or science fiction groups that broke up and fractured and became multiple other groups because of politics. And so just understanding the history there and the kind of the milieu that they were involved in is really important to understanding their politics and how to think about them through the lens of politics.
Yeah, I would say, following up on that, there's some biographies of Robert Heinlein, who is great. And Heinlein, in a lot of ways, Brian Doherty, 10, 15 years ago, wrote a great piece on the 100th birthday of Heinlein. Heinlein is kind of the spirit animal of reason, as much as Ayn Rand might have been, because he is, you know, at the beginning of the 60s, he was both a militarist as well as a free love advocate. He was an Aquarian and a war hawk. And that is, you know, that's a powerful vibe throughout modern libertarianism.
You can understand a huge amount about reason's worldview just by reading Stranger in a Strange Land and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Which, Stranger in a Strange Land, was the topic of my high school thesis essay.
Your high school thesis?
Yeah, in English.
Huh, fancy high school.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, you're just supposed to...
Was that a three-page paper?
It was... I'll show it to you.
Was it a five-paragraph essay?
It's called The Martian and the Hippies, and it was about how Stranger in a Strange Land informed and predicted the summer of love in 1967.
Wow.
It's all about the diggers.
Do you still have that?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. The writing is subpar, but the thinking is outstanding.
Matt, is it handwritten or typewritten? 18-year-old over.
Yeah. What kind of margins you got on that?
No, like, is
pretty
it
pretty squeezing?
Actually, I don't. I can't recall that.
Let's
example.
Upload it as a PDF.
My
an NFT.
My stepfather, Mike Townsend, who is probably not listening to this, but I hope that he is. He came into my life when I was around 12, and he had two big gambits. Like, one was the Ayn Rand gambit, and the other was the Robert Heinlein gambit. And the Ayn Rand, boy, that didn't stick. But I got into the Heinlein. So that was helpful. Let's take this more like for me and Nick, for reasons that'll easily become obvious, from Philip. With all due apologies to certain members of the roundtable, I'd like to ask a sports question. I love the free markets, which have given us...
Do you guys want to take five?
Let's only use that camera to show them. And you should have done the same thing.
If people do ask me about that, like, when you say, like, what is it like to make the podcast? They always specifically ask, like, what are you doing while Nick and Matt are talking nonsense?
I imagine it's like when Chang and Ang, the Siamese twins, when, you know, they were both married, and when one of them would have sex, the other one would kind of go into a twilight zone and not really. That's what I'm assuming you guys do when we talk about
by that comparison.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have called them conjoined twins.
Yeah. Thank you.
I apologize.
Moving on, I love the free markets, which have given us so many wonderful things, but I instinctively balk at extending this love to the concept of paying college athletes. I'm not opposed to paying them altogether, but my brain immediately wants to condition it with wage ceilings and floors, heavy regulation of recruiting practices, sponsorships and donor involvement, and other authoritarian seeming limits that would absolutely horrify me if applied to any other economic activity. I realize the reasons I think these things would be necessary in college sports are the same reasons that socialists think they are necessary everywhere: protect competition, level the playing field, limit the power of the wealthy, empower small business. in this case, small schools, et cetera. And that scares me. Do the challenges of college sports and athlete labor actually make a broader case for socialism, Dr. Nick? Wow. Am I wrong to think strict controls would be necessary to pay college athletes while still keeping their sports fair? Or do college sports and broader economics legitimately call for different solutions?
One, I would not argue that, you know, whatever happens in college football, thence the universe. Like these two things, you don't have to leap from one to the other. College sports and different divisions could be laboratories of democracy, of economic democracy and things like that. But I also don't understand how it's better to have them in a form of peonage now where they really don't. I mean, there's some of the likeness, you know, where NCAA athletes can get some money if they're popular based on their likeness, or their schools can. That comes back to them somehow, like giving them some money would be worse than giving them no money, which is the status quo.
And the status quo is also, it has been super heavily regulated. There's all these arcane rules that the NCAA does to maintain the illusion that there aren't incentives from outside donors and money polluting the system.
And more broadly, you know, let's say the NCAA, which is a monopoly, and there's a great book that was written by the Olympic marathoner turned fantastic sports journalist Kenny Moore about Bill Bowerman. It's called Bill Bowerman and the Men of Oregon. He was the Oregon track coach when Steve Prefontaine was there. Dozens of Olympians, world champions, et cetera. What is great about that book is it actually shows how the NCAA squeezed out the AAU in the 60s. Oh, right. And it's fascinating. But having said all of that, because these guys are starting to go to sleep and cobwebs are forming on them, all sorts of sub-markets have rules. So Major League Baseball, apart from, you know, the government granted monopoly on certain things, or football, you can come up with a league where you say, okay, we're going to have a bunch of rules. The New York Stock Exchange has rules and things like that. So there's nothing wrong with a league or a group of people coming together to do a certain activity, setting rules on compensation that implies that the whole world should be run by a socialist, covenant based in Zurich or something like that. I think it would be good if athletes were more directly compensated for their labor. I also think it would be great, and I say this as somebody who really was pissed when Michigan finally beat Ohio State for the first time in 11 years. On Sunday, I follow college football pretty religiously. I think it would be great if colleges got rid of their sports teams or gave the naming rights to autonomous organizations, put them on the blockchain, make them DAOs or something like that, but get sports out of college. Having said that, it'd be great to see athletes actually being compensated.
Yeah, they create value. They should get paid. And that should be fine. And the Supreme Court, the unanimous decision this year, laughed at these puny arguments, about the pristine nature of amateur athletics and all that kind of stuff. Like, stop it. We're getting close to the end. I want to get at least one more round of individualized things here. This to Suderman from Steve Schatz from New York. Nick, come on. What video game or video game series is the most libertarian, both thematically and actual gameplay?
Oh, man. Obviously, the Bethesda RPGs, in particular Fallout 3, Fallout 4, and Elder Scrolls Skyrim. Elder Scrolls Skyrim in particular, I would just say, is it's a game about individual choice. And so after a very short kind of tutorial introduction sequence, you can do anything, go anywhere, manipulate nearly any object in the world in a way that's really unprecedented in games that aren't made by Bethesda. But also, the overarching story here is about a world in which you have some kind of racist-seeming white Nord types who just want to practice their religion, and that's really all they want to do is be left alone by the kind of imperious, kind of dickish high elves who have taken over the society. And you have to choose between one of these two camps. And the point is that they're both awful. I don't want to say that this is an explicitly libertarian game made by libertarians who live just north of Washington, D.C., but it is a game made by a bunch of people who live not too far from the nation's capital, and it is alive to the dumbness and frustrations of politics, as well as, like, the glories of being in a world where you can choose to do and be anything.
Question to Catherine from Nathan, and hopefully there's a backstory, and hopefully there's not, even. It says, I have a question specifically for KMW. How dare you?
Wow. Spicy, Nathan. I don't know.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Nevertheless, I persisted. I don't know, man. How dare I? Okay. You know what I do dare
Maybe
to do?
Maybe it's an instructional question. How dare you?
Yeah, it could be.
Mm. Yeah, lots of ways to go.
You know what I do dare to do? I dare to just put in another plug here for our webathon. There are many ways you can donate. If you donate $1,000, you could have lunch with one of us here in the DC area.
And if you donate $2,000, you don't have to.
Yeah, right? Those are your two choices. You can also go ahead at this webathon moment and set up monthly donations.
That's
if you want
right.
to give us
recurring.
A little money now, you could make a recurring donation. It would be great. We would appreciate it. And that money will allow me to dare.
Well, the monthly option is great. I actually use it in much of my giving, both to Reason and elsewhere, because it's a little bit at a time.
It's a great if you have to make the choice every time, you're not going to make the choice, even though you want to make the choice.
This one to Nick from Stuart. Hello, big fan of the show. Listen every week. That's right, Stuart. Thank you.
Is it with an EW or a UA? I'm not going to answer depending on how the spelling goes.
EW.
Okay.
All right.
We're on.
My question is, a few weeks or months ago, Nick made a comment, more or less, that this might be the proof that Keynesian economics doesn't work. He didn't elaborate what he meant by that. I'm really curious as to what he meant by that and what examples he'd provide.
I have no idea what he's talking about, but I'll venture a guess.
Go.
Because one of the things, and this goes back to, we at some point early in this, which to quite honestly feels like 1,000 years ago when we started this thing. But
today.
This particular podcast.
And but we touched on inflation briefly. What is fascinating to me about what's going on right now is that everybody in Washington and all of the big wig economists who want to be part of Washington or already are talking about this completely as a supply issue. That, what's happened now that we're all done with COVID, even though all the lockdowns are coming back and all of this kind of shit, they're saying, what happened? And there's so much pent up demand and supply hasn't been able to increase. And that's why there's inflation, there's more people looking at the same supply of stuff. They keep ignoring the idea that we have pumped massive amounts of government money into the system, both through the Fed, but especially through the Treasury, through borrowing in order to spend all of this kind of stuff. 2 years ago, or in 2019, we were spending $4.5 trillion. We've had 2 years in a row where we've spent close to $7 trillion. And that's a huge problem. What I'm getting at about the Keynesianism stuff is that we're not having economic growth. We have had a sustained, bizarre kind of experiment in Keynesianism where the government is just pumping more and more money to, stimulate demand or to give people money to buy stuff, et cetera, for so long. And we have not seen, even going back to the 2008 financial crisis and the response to that, we haven't seen the kind of economic growth that should have come along with this type of consistently overly, targeted stimulus spending. So maybe it's that.
We're going to be wrapping up here very shortly. Thank you for listening and watching and for donating. Reason.com/donate, right?
Or slash webathon.
Both of them work. Go there. It's fun. I don't know if this will be our closing one. It might be, depending on how it's answered. This is from Peter, not Suderman. He's from New York City. I've got a life advice question for you. How important would you say your political philosophy is toward your dating life? I've never dated a libertarian because there's like three women who consider themselves libertarians and they all work at Reason. But that's not true. Some of them don't work at Reason. But someone's politics never really mattered when I met them or dated them. But I imagine there could be some conflict in a marriage when I have kids, because politics is a reflection of how you see the world. I doubt I could have a successful relationship with someone totally woke, but maybe I'm wrong. How important is it? And since you're all much older than I, I'd like to hear your thoughts and if you think your answer changed versus 20 years ago. Who wants to take that first?
Oh, that's interesting.
I'll go first because that's happening. So I actually, I met my husband in college and we met
on a
there were no yachts involved. There was one.
Yeah.
There's one yacht-based activity. Just one. Okay, but mostly it wasn't a yacht-based relationship. And we met in a debating society where we were both on the libertarian side of a kind of libertarian anarchist versus traditionalist Catholic conservative spectrum.
Where did you go? Yale?
All right. All right, everyone. And
how was Ross in that?
We were debate allies first, and then friends, and then we got together, and then we got married, and then we had kids, and it's a very nice story. And all of this is to say that that happened so long ago that I no longer remember what dating was like. But it's really great to be married to someone who agrees with you politically. I think this person is onto something that, like, that is a way to have a better and easier relationship. We still disagree on some stuff, but the, like, disagreeing from shared underlying values is the best kind of disagreeing. And my marriage has a lot of that, and I recommend it. So get yourself a nice libertarian girl. There's tons of us now. I used to get invited to all kinds of stuff just because, like, someone needed a lady on a panel, and they're like, so many ladies now. I never get asked to be the token lady anymore. And so it's good.
Peter, you're married, aren't you?
That's true. In fact, I am married to a libertarian who I met in the backyard of a blogger house party in Washington, D.C. And I'm not going to say who, but definitely.
Someone that Catherine was debating with?
No.
I think I know who it is.
But I'll just say that, you know, check the Substack charts.
I don't know why I get mocked, by the way. Like,
a terrible, like, appalling story.
Blah,
that
blah,
we,
blah. Yeah, it's like that story is more elitist
that
than
we
my story.
We have to turn away from that
story.
Yeah.
Turn so your face away. Go ahead. Sorry.
So my wife is a libertarian journalist and writes about this sort of thing, but also is I think it's fair to say, applies her libertarian philosophy somewhat differently than I do at times.
Does that mean that you pay for sex?
Wow.
Just ask.
We were so close to the end of this podcast.
I don't know.
I mean, everyone.
The markets and everything. Markets and everything, right?
In some sense.
It's like market-based management, but for marriage.
Of the currency you're using.
That's
really
true. Yeah.
I really hope that we only have Matt's cover on the shot as all of this is happening. It's valuable to have somebody else in the house who thinks from the same principles as Catherine was saying, but applies them differently. And because we both write about this stuff all the time, we talk about this sort of thing all the time. And I think that's something that helps. It keeps me thinking, right? It's not just that. So I don't just sort of show up to work and then, like, stop thinking about this stuff when I'm done. At night, when we're having dinner, when we're when we're watching Succession, we're talking through all of these things, and that means that there's always someone there to bounce ideas off of. And if you are a writer, particularly a writer who sort of traffics not just in kind of straight formal reporting, but in ideas and concepts and sort of ways of thinking about the world and about politics, the best way to shape your ideas is to have conversations with other people who are interested in your ideas, but think a little bit differently than you. And so having someone like that is just incredibly valuable. And I think it makes me a better thinker, a better writer. It means often that I'm exposed to ideas and just to facts and stories that I wouldn't have heard of otherwise, because here is somebody who with a different set of interests, a different way of looking at the world, but one that starts from a lot of the same premises. And it's great. Strongly recommend if you can find you can find a fellow libertarian journalist in the backyard of a DC blogger house party.
Put a chain on it and keep it in the basement.
Consensually.
Of course.
Yes, you're a doctor of dating.
I divorced from a libertarian, more of an anarchist than a libertarian, and I've had long-term relationships mostly, in the past 25, 30 years have been... The long-term relationships I've had have been with libertarians. So I feel like we're rubbing it in.
I know.
Because between
us, this question was like, is it going to be okay if I don't find a libertarian lady?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and it's like the libertarian lady is already taken. But
I dated
several libertarian ladies before I met the one who became my wife.
What I would say to this gentleman, Peter? Yeah, yeah. What I would say is, first off, like, don't worry about this kind of stuff so much. be interesting and be, you know, if you're interesting yourself and you're interested in other people, good things will happen to you. I don't think that necessarily like being in a relationship with a libertarian is the be all and end all. You want to be with somebody who is, you know, who you are compatible with, and politics can do that, but it's also sometimes you want something different, you know, or I mean, and part of me, for me, part of the libertarian philosophy is the idea that it's a refuge from politics. Like, you know, you're not always talking about politics. You're not always talking about this. It's pre-political. And if you find somebody who is interested in kind of a laissez-faire kind of light, you know, approach to the world, they don't need to be, you know, libertarian in some way or Misesian or, you know, Hayekian or anything like that. I think it's, you know, mostly you find somebody who you have a lot, you share a lot of interests with and a certain compatibility on a broad level of like, do you want to live in a world that is more open or less open? You know, that's you, sir, have the most instructive relationship, I think, in all of this.
I doubt it. Married to a French woman, as people might know. I wouldn't describe Emmanuel as libertarian, but she is a donor.
And how long have you guys have been married?
So people do that too?
Yeah, if you go to reason.com/Matt's wife,
cool.
You can donate to our annual.
That URL does not work. I want to be clear.
You have been married for what, 20 years?
What will happen is
you have a highly functioning, you know.
We've been married for 24 years. Are we still in 2021? So next year will be our whatever the 25 year anniversary is.
It's good to know how long it's
the
boulders or something.
Gold or paper?
Gold's going to be like 50.
Silver is 50, isn't it?
Since I never gave her an engagement ring, I guess it's like, it's time to.
Could be the time.
She should give you one. It should be an equal exchange.
That's an excellent idea. Anyways, we met in Eastern Europe where we lived, not a libertarian, but you know.
Wait, you lived in Eastern Europe.
It's true.
Have you ever talked or written about
Middle
that?
Europa? Really. We got
the shot, Lord of the Rings.
We had commonality on the big question, which is communism sucks, and you know, she's French, but and has French tastes and things like healthcare systems. But at the same time,
my friend,
it's more complicated than that. As readers will know, I'll let the search button be your guide. She hasn't lived in France as an adult, basically since the age of 21. And there's a reason for that. She's now an American citizen. She's attracted to the more free and wide open American life. This is common among French expats here. Like, there isn't just one school that you have to go to that sends you in this direction. You can just kind of keep reinventing. She reinvents it as a private investigator midway through her journalistic career. So we have those big things in common.
You bonded over, among other things, The Cure, right?
She was a member of the International Cure fan club, kind of secretary, and wrote about it. And I like The Cure. I've been to a few of The Cure freak concerts, not as many.
But what I'm getting at is that you share a broadly consistent worldview, but it was other interests than politics or ideology.
Yeah, probably had more to do with journalism and Central Europe, but also commies are bad and life should be fun and filled with adventure and seeking, I think.
Which is a pretty good first approximate order of a libertarian worldview, a pre-political worldview, right? Life should be fun and open and innovative.
Yes. I think that's all the dating tips that we're going to have time for.
That was a rousing ending of a real humdinger.
If we're going to make each other awkward, we should have listeners making us awkward as well. Thank you again for getting to the bottom of this. Catherine, is there anything they should know or think about right at the end of this?
You know, one thing that occurs to me is that we are having a webathon, and so people should consider donating to it, Matt.
Is that a tax deductible?
It is a tax deductible donation, and your donation not only gets you some cool swag, but also supports the important work that Reason does to make the world safe for free minds and free markets.
And you can bid on pixelated versions of our faces. Nick.
Yeah. Go to, if you go to reason.com, you will get a link to the NFT, the Reason Roundtable NFT, which is currently being auctioned off by one of our trustees of the nonprofit Reason Foundation, Ted Barnett, has a long history in tech. That's a wonderful shot of the four of us, the Reason Roundtable crew, in beautiful pixelated 8-bit form. You know, you need to know a little bit about NFTs and about Ethereum in particular. It's not that complicated. It's less complicated than most video games. You can learn how to already like lose all of the money that you've invested in crypto. You know, it'll take like 1 or 2 hours to blow it all on our NFT. It's a unique piece of history. And Reason is a magazine that likes to make history. So
sell a couple of ships in EVE Online and make a bid.
You can also just give us your crypto directly if you want.
That's true.
Like, we accept many forms.
And we take fiat even. We're not particular at this point.
You can send us an envelope of cash, honestly, whatever you want.
And also make sure to put those little things in comments as you're donating. Send us a comment. What do you like? What got you here? Suggestions and things like that. I'd mentioned, I guess, offhandedly that people should send limericks.
Yeah, we did.
And you did.
We got some good ones.
You did. I'm just going to read one from Bob. Bob from Illinois, also known as on Twitter at the Purple Pros, P-R-O-S, like professionals. On a recent roundtable, most dreadful, the hosts were each rendered forgetful, like a Smollett assault. The pod screeched to a halt on a Welchian transitional word pretzel. Bob.
That's good.
You win. You win the podcast. You don't have to donate.
We want your money, but we will accept your limericks.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye. Have a pleasant tomorrow. Bye.